Good job. I'd like to offer your attention for some thoughts on the context of our practice. You have all been practicing quite diligently today, as far as I could make out. And I think it's crucial that we learn something about the context of this practice, something of the bigger picture. If we look at a meditation retreat, it seems that people just sit on the floor and try to concentrate their attention on one particular part of their experience. That doesn't seem to be wildly fascinating. And it's not immediately obvious why we do that. So, it makes sense to look at some of the Buddha's understanding of how the mind comes to make experiences, what can go wrong in that process, and what is actually desirable, what is useful, what gives us a perspective of an undistorted take on reality, on what's happening to ourselves, what's happening to others, what's happening to the world. The Buddha's understanding is based on experience. It's based on a very existential fact that our capacity to be with something, our capacity to attend, our capacity to be mindful of something is not unbiased. On the contrary, it is strongly biased. We are a lot more willing and capable of being mindful with things that are pleasant. We are not neutral. This is crucial. If you are conscious of the fact that your receptivity for experience is strongly in favor of pleasant experiences, then you will be understanding why we do this exercise. One of the major jobs for practicing meditation is that we learn to be equally mindful whether we like something or whether we don't like something. It's quickly told why. If we like something and we are mindful, it means we are only going to be paying attention to things we like. If we turn away our attention from things we don't like, because that is our habit, we are unlikely to learn something from the things we don't like. So far, so good. If the unpleasant things would stop, if we stop paying attention to them, that would be brilliant. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. Unhappy experiences have a dreadful tendency to repeat themselves if we are not willing to learn from them. There seems to be an inbuilt loop in our system that things keep coming back until we're prepared to understand them. That's true for small things, but we keep making the same mistakes until we're prepared to learn what we are doing wrong, to understand more deeply how we can avoid it. And it seems true on the big scale. Whether you like this or whether you don't like this, whether you believe this or don't, Buddhist teaching seems to start from the point that we have done this many times over. We come back to this world, we come back to these bodies, we come back to experience, to learn something. That's the big picture. If you're not interested in the big picture, take a look at the small picture. The things we learn generally take some effort. It takes some clarity. It takes some determination. And it takes a particularly magical skill called sati that helps us understand things. There are two ways we define sati generally. One way is we define it in terms of length, duration. So mindfulness is something that can be of short duration or that can be of long duration. The other way of defining mindfulness is in terms of breaths, not temporal length, but the range of mindfulness, the domain of something. How big can my mindfulness be? Mindfulness, sati, awareness, attention, presence of mind, all these words mean one single crucial term in Buddhist psychology called sati, the sati of satipatthana, the sati of anapanasati. These are terms for two of the famous meditational teachings. This mindfulness is an everyday experience. It happens right now for you. It's not something extraordinary. It's not a lofty meditative attainment. It's an everyday capacity of mind. It's a function of mind, in fact. And if you didn't have some sati, you wouldn't have managed to get here. Yeah. So the dramatic thing about sati is not that it happens. The dramatic thing about sati is when it happens a long time. Yeah. It's the continuity of sati that brings about miracles. So how would we identify a moment of mindfulness? How do we identify when mindfulness actually takes place? It's quite difficult. Yeah? If we're fish and swimming in the water, it's very difficult to talk about the water. It seems so normal. Yeah? So sati has a couple of functions. It has qualities. And it has some significance. So let's do that orderly. Start with the history of its significance. There's a term called smriti that comes from the Vedic tradition. In the Vedic tradition, smriti means something like that which has been memorized. Often it is referred to as the texts that are outside of the strictly Vedic tradition. The Buddha, like with many other things, has taken that term and has radically redefined it. Like he's redefined many other things. The term yoga, for example, which in the Vedic or in the Upanishadic tradition means the union, yoga, the yoke, that harnesses together two oxen in old days. That's where the English word yoke comes from. It's related to the term yoga. The term yoga in the Vedic tradition meant the union of Atman, the individual soul, with Brahman, the universal soul, if you want, or the universal consciousness. The Buddha took that term and gave it another meaning. When the Buddha speaks of yoga, or more precisely of Anuyoga, he means dedication to a spiritual practice. It means giving yourself to something. So let us go back to sati. The Buddha made that term in many ways psychological. Rather than just meaning that which has been memorized, the term sati comes to mean various functions of mind. The first function of mind is the capacity that there can experiences take place, that there is a space in which things can happen. Yeah. So sati opens up a field of experience. It opens up a continuum of experience. If there wasn't sati, you wouldn't be able to connect two thoughts. You wouldn't be able to connect colors. You wouldn't be able to connect your other five senses. So sati in some way offers the connective tissue. It offers the cohesion between our sensory apparatus, between our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our capacity to touch, and our capacity to conceive, to remember, and to correlate. So sati is the connective tissue. If you don't have sati, you have deep trouble. You're in deep trouble. People in white shirts will give long and ugly names to your condition if you do. In Thailand, the word katsati means you're crazy. Yeah. Literally, this means your sati is broken. You cannot connect one thing to the other. So understand, sati is at once something totally ordinary as the water for fishes, because you use it every moment. On another level, sati is dramatic in its effect if it is expanded, either expanded in time, or if it is expanded in space. Yeah. If the area in which we become aware grows. In meditation practice, particularly early Buddhist meditation practice, which is what most of us probably are familiar here with, is we're trying to extend our capacity to be aware of something. Notice that sati has, besides the function of actually connecting one piece of my experience with the next piece, it has also the capacity to be aware of different things. Sati is not one-pointed. It is not concentration. It is not unified. It is big. It is integrative. It can take on board many things. Think of driving a car. If you want to drive a car, you need to do many things at the same time. You need to turn your key, you need to look what's happening on the road, you need to put in first gear, you need to release your handbrake, and you look whether there is a spot where you can actually join the queue. You need to drive, you need to read signals, and look what the kids do on the back seat. There's many things you need to do. You can't just concentrate on your ignition key. Concentrate, concentrate, concentrate. Yeah. It doesn't work. The same is true for many things in our daily life. Raising kids, for example, can't afford not being very, very scanning with your awareness. Yeah. So sati can scan. And while it can stay with one thing, it doesn't lose the other things. That's the big thing about sati. You see? It can favorize one aspect of your experience without losing the other aspects. So there's something like a periphery of sati, which is out here, and you may have something that is dominant. But you don't just stay with the dominant bit and lose the rest. That's what concentration does. That's useful, but for a different story. Sati keeps your experience unified. One of the things sati does, it sticks. You can decide. That's the great thing about sati, is you can decide where it goes. If you don't make such a decision, it just goes to the loudest thing, to the thing that is most dramatic in your experience. You sit here, you listen to me, somebody's honking the horn outside, your experience, your sati will go there. Yeah. That's what a conditioned mindfulness does. It just goes to the most, to the strongest experience, and if it has a choice, it goes to the most pleasant experience. See, that's very bad for learning, because if we only learn from the pleasant experiences, the not pleasant experiences will keep getting repeated because we don't understand them. Yeah. So you have a big problem. The more you want the pleasant only, the more the unpleasant keeps kind of coming in and repeating itself. So one of the wonders about sati is that it is capable of staying with something that changes. You know, your breath, for example. Your breath isn't a fixed thing. It moves. Yeah, it increases, it decreases, it moves in your body. And sati is capable of following an experience you have chosen. Now, if we don't make this choice, what wins is habit. If your habits haven't brought you to enlightenment yet, it is unlikely that your habits will make you enlightened. So it's well worth finding out what these habits are and see whether we can improve on these habits. Many of you are young, some of you have a couple of gray hairs, but I can assure you, if habits would get us enlightened, we would be all a lot faster enlightened than is the case. And if you have any doubts whether you are enlightened, I can reassure you, if you are enlightened, you will know. Yeah. It's not something that you will miss. So sati has a tremendous potential. There is something intrinsically curative about sati. See, all the things in our lives, they want to be seen, felt, heard. All they want is attention. We need that. You know, like little children need attention. They don't just need food or life insurance or brilliant education in 20 years' time or something. They need attention. It is due to being attended to that other people take care of us and that take an active interest in our well-being by giving us their attention that we actually grow up. That's the most stimulating factor for learning. And it's the most disastrous thing we can do to somebody growing up, to not give attention. It's taken me a long time to understand. I thought the most cruel thing is abuse, you know, physical, emotional, sexual. That's true, that's cruel, that's bad. But worse than that is strategically not giving attention to somebody who needs it. That's worse. Psychologically, that leaves us in the weakest, in the most vulnerable, in the most devastating place. So our own mind, in some way, often resembles a child. You know, sometimes it's 48 and sounds very reasonable, and sometimes it sounds about like 6 years old and doesn't sound so reasonable. It says, I'm happy, or I'm sad, or I'm not getting what I want, or, you know. I don't know how yours sounds, I know how mine sounds. You will know how yours sound, I'm sure. So the mind often has something childlike. You know? It wants things, it's afraid of things, it doesn't want things. So these emotions, they make something to our sati. We shrivel, we shrink. You know? So our sati can change its quality. It can become very superficial. Or it can become very brittle, very porous. You know? It can be very dry, flaky. And it's important that we learn how to gauge what quality our sati currently has. So one of the first things we do when we sit down in meditation, we ask for things of the body. We ask, body, how are you doing? Are you here? What do you feel? Is there a heart beating? Is there a breath coming and going? Where is the weight going in the body? So what that does means it is your sati is moving through the body. And your sati brings back sensations. If your sati is good, if you have plenty of energy, then your sati will bring back many physical sensations. It will say, there is a tingling in my left ear, and then it goes into a pulsation, and then it goes into a little throbbing, and then it goes into a nice warm fullness, a little above that. If your sati is very tired or very brittle, it'll say, nothing is happening, everything is like usual, nothing new. Yeah. It will not bring back anything. It's like the fairy tale. I don't know whether you have fairy tales here, but fairy tales generally have something to do with initiation. So, mommy wants to find out whether her boy is big enough for some of the truth of life. So she sends him into the forest and says, bring back wood. A boy goes into the forest and he brings back very little wood, you know, very thin branches, very tiny little sticks. So mommy knows it's not very grown up yet. You know, have to wait another 7 years. 7 years later, he gets sent back out in the forest. He brings back really fine branches. And mommy knows, well, right now he's ready for his next initiation. We can teach him a few things. The little boy who goes into the forest, this is our sati. So it's very difficult to actually feel your sati. Like I assume it's difficult for the fish to feel the water he's moving in. But what we can recognize is the quality of sati is obvious according to the quality of felt experiences that sati brings to our understanding. So if we are conscious of many bodily experiences, then we can be sure that our sati is fresh, that it is alive, that it is willing and malleable, yeah, it's useful to work. If our sati is thin and superficial, it will not bring back much wood from the forest. It will not bring back many body experiences. It will be very superficial. There's nothing there. Somewhere must be something, but there's nothing there. I can't really feel anything. If that sati is fresh, obviously we can just put it to work. We can say, dear sati, please go and look at the breath, feel the breath, tell me more about the breath. I want to get closer to the breath. I want to know more about breath. How is the in-breath? How is the out-breath? Is it long? Is it short? How is the rhythm? How is the texture? How is its depth? How far down does it go? Does it feel good? If the sati is weak and it doesn't want to operate, we have to wake it up first. No point in giving it orders and say, go and bring much wood, you know, tiny little boy, doesn't work. You have to make him strong. So how do you make sati strong? First of all, you are honest. That's one of the really useful things. You're honest and say, this is how it is. Right now, there isn't much energy in the system. We need to wake up that system. You need to massage your sati. Yeah? It needs massage. Sati can be massaged by questions. You drop in gentle questions. You say, can you go into my left leg, sati? See whether there is a left leg. If there is a left leg, tell me something about it. If I remember right, there was something on the right side as well. Can you go there and bring something back? So rather than try to be very, very precise and very, very specific, yeah, detailed, you say, just go and look. If there's something, fine, come back, tell me. Send it to the right leg and say, well, is there something? Come back and tell me. It says, yes, there is something. Can you go down a bit further? Can you go in a bit more deeply? And it'll probably go there. Suddenly you start feeling a tingling in your knee or something of a weight in your thigh, or you start to feel your hand, you know, where your thigh is. So we can stimulate our sati by asking questions, by curiosity. As I said sometime today, I think it was in here, curiosity is the mother of awareness. You know, we need to be curious. If you're not curious, nobody can help you. Not even the Buddha. Yeah, it needs you, and it needs you being interested. There are many words for this curiosity in the Pali tradition. Chanda is one. A kind of interest, something that stimulates you. Something in us is curious and wants to know. If we are not depressed, or if we are not traumatized, and something in us wants to know. Human beings have in their own hearts an intrinsic capacity to be happy, and they know that. You know, even if they're miserable, they still remember that they can be happy. Because we don't forget this, we want to learn. We want to grow. We want to wake up. You cannot stop human beings from trying to wake up. You see, that's the beauty in all this. There's something in us that wants to grow up, be free, and be liberated. Imagine a circle, a huge big circle. Imagine that this circle is fragmented, that it is shattered to pieces. However small the pieces are of that circle, yeah, a tiny little circle, if you look at that tiny little piece of the circle clearly, you can see in that little piece there is a rounding, yeah? There's something round in that piece. And from that little rounding in that piece, you can get a feeling how big the circle is. Yeah? Every little piece is going to tell you how big the whole of it is. Yeah? You cannot lose it. So however fragmented our happiness is, however fragmented our freedom is, if we attend to what happens to us, we can free ourselves, we can grow. You see, that is the big big message that the Buddha gave 2,500 years ago. He said, if you in wisely attend to your experience with your perception and with your consciousness contains everything for you to become free. Yeah. In this fathom-long body with its perception and with its consciousness, I declare the arising of suffering and I declare the cessation of suffering. This is a very powerful statement. It means that if we are carefully and attentively turning to what's happening to us, we find in that experience of ours enough to become free human beings. This is a big statement. Yeah. It's a big statement if you look at it in terms of religious history. I'm not aware of anybody who said that 2,500 years ago, empowered human beings to turn to their own experience and to cultivate an understanding of their own experience that would liberate them without recourse to a god or to some other force. This is a very, very empowering statement. If we meditate, if we do exercises, please do not mistake these exercises with the big vision. The big vision is not to spend the rest of your life in a meditation hall, in a stuffy meditation hall, I might say, and try to force your attention into a tiny spot at the top, at the tip of your nose. That is not freedom. Yeah, that's the workshop. We go to the workshop because good things happen there. But that's not the vision of freedom. The vision of freedom is the context of this exercise. So please, if we do these exercises, do not forget the big vision. The big vision is very clear. It says human beings are entitled to be free. If we are honest, there is something in us that both knows that we can be free and that longs for this freedom. The Buddha says very clearly, there's much happiness in this world. The problem with most of this happiness is it doesn't last very long. And if we mistake that longing we carry in our hearts with the things we can gratify through the things we do or the things we become or the things we eat or visit, then we have a problem. We will always be disappointed because these things cannot quench our thirst. They cannot quench our longing for freedom and for a genuine happiness. So to wake up to that, we have to take a long, hard look at what is happening in our lives. We have to be prepared to learn things, and maybe more difficultly, we have to be prepared to unlearn things. You know, some of the things we like to believe about ourselves may not be true. The magic of mindfulness, the magic of sati, of the presence of mind, is powerful. It is powerful because it helps us reconcile with deep, profound truth. The truth of impermanence is one of these truths. It's a big topic. You know, impermanence out there is easy. Things change. You know, leaves change, governments change, shares change, all kinds of things change. That's easy. But it's more complicated than that. Not just things out there change, also the apparent solid subject in here who witnesses the change out there changes. That is a bit more frightening because at the end of it, this means this solid subject that is experiencing the change out there is going to disappear sooner or later. This world is going to turn black under his senses or under her senses. That is a thought most of us don't really handle very long time. You know? We don't really handle the thought that we are going to disappear from this world very easily. So our psyche has developed a few tricks against this realization that we are going to die. One of these tricks is called I. Yeah. It's a fictional character that appears somewhere between your ears. Yeah. And because it is fictional, it needs constant repair. Yeah. It needs constant fixing up. It completely goes away unless it is supported, unless it is affirmed. And one of the things sati practice teaches us is how frail the sense of I is, how constructed it is, how dependent it is. Another thing sati teaches us is that there is a quality of unsatisfactoriness that is woven into everything in this world. Everything we can experience through our senses, everything we can think of, everything we can become aware of has an inbuilt dukkha factor, yeah, as the Buddhists call it. An inbuilt factor of not quite enough, or if it is perfectly enough, there is the feeling it might end, or I might not get it tomorrow, or maybe I lose the taste for it. Yeah? The quality that the Buddha calls dukkha, that which is hard to endure. The English translation, suffering, for that, it's not false, but it's unfortunately simplistic. Yeah? Dukkha is a lot more profound than simple suffering. You know, it's not just an ailment, like a kidney ailment, or a disjoint vertebrae or something like that. Dukkha is that which separates us right now from enlightenment, that which separates us from complete freedom, complete ecstatic happiness, complete ability to act spontaneously. That is what the Buddha calls dukkha. Now, most of us would probably not think of ourselves as suffering very much right now. I don't seem to suffer right now very much. And yet, there's something in me that is clear that the complete freedom and complete happiness have a different taste than my life tastes right now. So the second thing that sati teaches us about is this mysterious, poignant, bittersweet quality called dukkha in our lives. And the last big quality, the last of these three hallmarks of existence that we come into deeper touch with, the Buddha speaks of, is the impersonality of our experience. That we identify with aspects of our experience. My thoughts, my feelings, my body, my problems, my capacities. This identification with some parts of my experience. It can also work negatively. I'm not one of those. I don't have anger. I don't have envy. I don't have jealousy. I'm not like these people. I am a better person. This also is a form of identification. This thing also is something that sati gradually unravels. The sati helps us to be more here. It helps us to actually taste better, see more clearly, think more profoundly. Sati helps us to resonate with each other more profoundly. To be honest, I don't know of any other thing that is so precious for human beings than the attunement, the fineness, and the quality of their awareness, of their sati. That's the most precious thing I would know of human beings being able to give to each other and to give to themselves. Consider what is precious in your life. Consider how these words connect with your experience. Let us try to identify briefly a few aspects of a moment of mindfulness. How does a moment of mindfulness taste? Any ideas? This is a serious question. I'm listening.
Free.
Good.
Delicious.
Delicious.
A big smile.
Okay, happy with a big smile.
Maybe something about the feeling of the time.
Something about the feeling of time. You mean it's going to be like elastic, very broad, or tiny little grains of sand, or what do you mean?
It's not a second one, maybe. Maybe timeless.
Maybe timeless?
Effortless.
Effortless? Mm-hmm.
Like being home, no fear.
No fear, like being home.
No difference between inside and outside.
Uh-huh. No difference between inside and outside. Let me see whether I can add a few. Okay, something that puts the rest of my life into perspective, as if I am born in this moment, as if this is a kind of new beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
I had one anchored. Anchored.
Anchored. Good, let me see. A moment of sati is always something unexpected. I think that's one of the things. Sati is between, is on the edge of what I know. It is, there is always a quality of something amazing, of something new, of something unknown in it. Yeah. Sati is intentional, to be very clear. Yeah. It's an intentional quality. If it is something that has to do with how I direct the mind. If I don't have this intentional quality in sati, it is carried away. The stream of thoughts will carry it away. So to stay present means I have to make some form of effort to stay present. That effort may be very subtle. In fact, if the effort is too strong, your sati will scatter. Yeah? It'll be sweating too much. But there is a subtle intention that stays with one thing, that stays with the change of one thing. Yeah? Imagine if you look at the wave, for example. If you want to stay with that wave, you have to follow that wave. Yeah? Sati is non-judgmental. Where sati occurs, in a moment of sati, in a moment of mindfulness, you don't have a judgment. You don't say it's good, you don't say it's bad. You don't say I want this, you don't say I don't want this. There is no judgment. Sati is pre-conceptual. You don't have words. The words will come afterwards. There is a moment of amazement, a moment of you are stunned. You are. Have we lost our voice?
Yes.
No. Okay. I'm fiddling with the cable a little bit and hope it's coming back. Yeah. It is not words that come to mind. Where sati occurs, it may be followed by words, but where it actually grows, there's something fresh. It is pre-conceptual. It happens before the mind has words. See, the words in Buddhist psychology, they come in after we compare the current experience with our memory. At that point, we have words for things. When we experience blueness, something goes to the memory banks and says, this color is called blue. Yeah, this blueness is blue. That is already past the moment where sati has occurred. Yeah. So, what else is there? We have freedom, feeling at home. We have Somebody said effortless. Somebody said anchored. Somebody said time is different. The experience of time is different. Then we had it is pre-conceptual. It happens before the words fill up the space of the mind. I said it is intentional insofar as it is directed. It doesn't just go anywhere. It offers a continuity of experience. One thing. I said it is without judgment. It doesn't refer back to our value systems. Sati is neither good nor bad. Sati doesn't make things good or bad, in fact. You can clean out bank safes with sati. In fact, if you have a habit of cleaning out bank safes, you better do it with sati, otherwise your problems will quickly increase. So sati is not a moral or it's amoral. In Buddhist psychology, it occurs generally with wholesome states. But in itself, it is neither moral nor unmoral. Consider, please, where that happens in your experience. Consider for a moment that this actually happens to you. If you feel that this doesn't happen to you, I venture to say that you're not quite straight with me. Yeah. I venture to say that you may be imagining this to be more mystical, that you may be imagining this to be something different than it is. It's a most ordinary quality. It is accompanied every moment where you have curiosity, where you have continuity of awareness, where you have some moment of insight. Yeah. Little insights happen in sati, even without big concentration. You make connection. Yeah. Something emerges as a whole thing. And it is something you haven't known before. It is something from the edge of what you know. It is something that is fresh. It has a quality of surprise in it. Please take with yourself these few thoughts tonight. Consider that this sati is not a mystical quality. The powerful thing about sati is if we manage to extend it, if we manage to continually stay with something. Yeah, it is through the continuity of experience that we deepen, that we get a feeling for the pattern. Yeah. There are many tricks why the mind doesn't understand what's happening. One thing is, one obvious thing is desire. We want something very badly. And because we want it so badly, we don't see the disadvantages of it. Another thing that obstructs our vision is anger. Yeah. If we're angry, it's very difficult to be clear. If we're angry, people look ugly. Yeah. If we love somebody, people start looking beautiful. Yeah. It's very easy. It's very difficult to say something about somebody whom you really love, to really say how this person is, because if you love this person, then you will give this person lots of your attention. Because you give this person lots of your attention, you will know that this person changes. Yeah, that she has or he has many faces. And so it becomes difficult to say he is like that or she is like this. If we don't like somebody, it's very easy to say how they are. Yeah, very easy. She's always like that. Silly cow. Yeah, very easy. It's like a caricature, you know, with a black crayon. You just make nose, couple of eyes, that's it, a bad man. Yeah. So not paying attention makes it easy to be judgmental, makes it easy to put our experience in little frames, yeah, in little perceptual frames. By being loving, which is one form of attending to somebody, yeah, we see changes, we follow, we are willing to be with something, and it becomes suddenly difficult to put this person in a description or in a pigeonhole. That happens not just with great hatred and with great love, that happens all the time in our day, in our lives. You know. If we think carefully, if we withhold our judgment, if we follow continuously something, we are much more likely to understand the pattern behind it. That's the same when you do arithmetics or when you try software problem solutions or when you learn some craft, something with your hands. It is the continuity of your willingness to apply yourself to something that gives you the insight how it works. Same with meditation. I think what I'm trying to say is be patient. We have started something good. Make use of the time here. Apply yourselves gently and persistently. There is a great skill in doing things precisely and gently. Yeah. It's not immediately apparent that this is possible. Many of us can be quite precise, but then somehow we stop being gentle. Yeah, we get a bit obsessed or a bit compulsive or a bit sort of control freakish. Or, yeah. And if we're gentle and nice, we get a bit sloppy. Yeah, so there is a great skill in learning to be with one's own experience, mindful, both precise, without negligence, and yet with gentleness, with a well-meaning, warm gentleness. That is crucial. So, enough of myself for today. I'd like to stop here, quickly open up if there are any things I could clarify, any questions, practical or theoretical. If not, I'll let you go. Good. Thanks for your attention. Let us sit for a few moments still.